folks, you're listening to myself, Andy Chaplin, and Neil Geddes Ward on the Paranormal Peep Show on the Paranormal Radio UK network. Neil, how have you been?
I'm fine, and it's Paranormal UK Radio Network, but that's close enough.
It's close enough.
That keep Irene and Mark happy. Because
see, the thing is, Irene has been doing this for years, and she fluffs the same thing.
She does indeed. She does. Yeah. She's always tripping herself up with it, and I always laugh when I listen back to it.
And she also fluffs Mark's name, bless him, as well.
Yeah. And she's known him for years.
Host for like 6 or 7 years, whatever.
Yeah. I mean, we know what our names are. And I think that's enough, really, just to get the show across on the air, as it were. Anyway, how are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Recovering from the heat wave, so it's been a tad hot in the UK. I'm more of a temperate person, really. I don't like freezing cold, but I don't like the sweltering temperatures we have had.
It's like spring weather. I prefer the spring.
Mm, or autumn. Halloween, of course, is like...
Yes.
Halloween is my Christmas, I think, definitely.
Are you preparing your events for October, the Halloween festivals and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, October is a very busy time for us. It's like the peak time of year. August kind of winds down a little bit. But October is definitely my favourite time of year, definitely the busiest and also the spookiest as well, which I'm quite enjoying.
Do you get lots of gothic types come to your events around that time, or is it they're not really interested in that sort of thing, maybe?
Oh, yeah, yes. I mean, certainly our readers dress up for it, and I dress up for it, and we kind of overkill on the whole pumpkins and cobwebs and all that kind of thing, so... Yeah, but we really do get all sorts coming. We get young, old, male, female, goths, non-goths, all sorts.
So you might have heard of Whitby then?
Yes. There's a goth festival up there, apparently. That's
exactly right. And our next guest is actually in Whitby as we speak. That's where he's calling in from tonight.
And it's actually one of the people that is kind of on my top list of people to interview. So I'm actually quite looking forward to this. And I've actually referred to him in previous shows on and off to do with his not exactly channelings, but kind of his information, I suppose we'd call it. But we'll find out how he gets his information in a little bit. So welcome to the show, Simon Parks.
Well, hello, Andy, and hello, Neil. And that's a very good linking introduction you did.
Oh, I'm professional at those sorts of things. Anyway, how are you, Simon, this evening?
Very well, thank you.
Good. Okay, Andy, well, you've seen Simon. You've had the benefit of seeing Simon at, is it the Awake and Aware conferences?
That's it. With the ones in Watford at the High Elms Manor. Fantastic location, fantastic people. Always have an amazing time there. And Simon Parks has been on my paranormal radar, I suppose you could call it, for quite a few years now. I actually forgotten how I got into listening to you, Simon. it must have been a random link. And it might have been when you were with the JP radio. But the information kind of resonated with me, and your presentation, I think, is quite humble and kind of down to earth, which I liked, because there's a lot of, in this field of, I suppose you could call it the spiritual or the ET or the UFO world, there's a lot of egos flying around, and you don't have that ego, and I quite like that. And I was also quite fascinated with the experiences that you've had, because you'd probably describe yourself as a contactee rather than an abductee, and maybe you could go into what the difference is between that.
Yes, I prefer the word sort of experiencer, because many experiences are not abductions or, you know, taken to a spacecraft or taken to an underground base. Many of the experiences are where an interdimensional being or an extra dimensional being will appear in your front room or your kitchen and then mind link with you, give you an experience. You know, many people think they've gone to Mars and they really feel they have gone to Mars, but actually they haven't. They've had 30 seconds with a non-human entity. And the reason for that is it's much more cost effective to go into somebody's mind and give them an experience, let's say for Mars, than it is to take them to Mars, because, you know, there are so many other agencies that are watching the situation. And every time you take a human from the Earth and take him or her somewhere else, there's a chance of being intercepted. So I would say out of every 10 experiences that everybody has on the planet, maybe 7 of them, they're not quite what they seem.
So, I mean, this we thank you so much for coming on the show, Simon. It's really great to have you. For this particular show, we've got Simon for an hour. So I will say to listeners, please do go on to Simon's website for the full rundown. So that would be Simon Parks with an E and then .org. Is that correct, Simon?
Thank you.
So we're going to have a kind of like a cut short version, not because we're not interested in the information, but literally the time factor. But if people do want to find out the extended version, I would say definitely go on the website. And indeed, there's been many, many other interviews with Simon going into much greater detail. But Simon, for people who are completely new to yourself, could you give us a short rundown in where you're coming from, how you came into the information that you've come into, and your early experiences, if possible? It's a lot to ask, I know, in a short time.
Sure. I mean, if this radio show is well received, and your audience, you know, want that, then I'm happy to come back and do another hour at a later date.
Fantastic.
Let's see how well it goes. Yes, of course. For those who have not even heard of my name, I grew up in what we would call an intelligence family. It doesn't mean the people were intelligent. They worked for the intelligence services. My mother was British, and she worked for what we call MI5, but really she was working for the National Security Agency of the United States. My grandfather, who was also English or British, he worked for MI6, but really he was working for the CIA. So my mother's single parent, and I was just the one child. Excuse me. So when I grew up in an environment where this was the norm. And my mother's job was to, she was a fantastic typist. This is before computers and word processors were in the civilian sector. And she was a phenomenal speller. Her ability to spell words is quite incredible. And her job was to type up documents that had come from German scientists from the western part of Berlin. Remember now, we're talking about 1966. So there was a West Germany and an East Germany. So these were German scientists who actually their statehood, they were managed by MI5, because if they had remained German, they would have been sent to the Nuremberg trials and they would have then been either imprisoned or executed. So because these scientists were so important, and the Americans had nicked most of the scientists and the Russians had nicked the other group, the British were allowed this sort of rump of scientists left. So they were actually owned, if that's the right word, by MI5, so that the Western Germany could not prosecute them for Nazi crimes. So there was a small group of scientists in Western Germany, and when anything that the American scientists, the Germans, couldn't work with through work pressure or specialism, then this task would go to the scientists in West Germany. They would do the work, and then this document would come all the way to Britain, and my mother was tasked with typing out the document. So the document would arrive in German, and she would have what we call an old dictaphone. It's an old foot-pedaled control tape, and you have earphones in, and you'd hear one sentence in German and then one sentence in English, and her job was to type it out all in English. And then when she'd done that, she would take the document to Brighton railway station, and then she'd hand it to an agent. And this all of these documents related to crashed UFO craft that had come down all over the earth and had been retrieved by the United States of America. These documents pertained to that. So I grew up from a 3D perspective, if you like, in a very interesting intelligence-led environment.
So roughly speaking, this might be impossible to say. You say there's multiple UFO crashes. Everyone kind of thinks of Roswell as the main one. I mean, how many per year, roughly, would you know might be crashing all over the earth that we're unaware of?
I would say that Roswell is the most important one, not because of the crash, but because of what it was all about. So I've always said that Roswell is the king or queen of the UFO world. I would suggest that there are probably between 6 and 12 recoverable incidents every year.
So the next question would be, and it's quite an obvious question, if these are beings with high technology, what's bringing them down and how are they allowing their ships to be brought down?
Well, in the case of the Roswell, it was deliberate. That doesn't really answer your question. The humans now have technology that can bring down some races' craft. They have that now. Sometimes, very occasionally, it's an error. That's incredibly rare. Normally, the craft that are crashed are because they're fighting above us, and one side shoots down another, and that sort of remains comes down onto the Earth. So the vast majority of crashes on the Earth are literally because one race is fighting another race, and the gravitational pull of the Earth brings it down.
Wow. So the races is an interesting one, because Simon, you're one of the rare people who have actually met different races. Tell us about your early experiences with the greys and the reptilians and the mantids.
I think quite a few people have that experience, but for whatever reason, most people who have these experiences are, and I, you know, it's very hard to quantify, but they don't have the, they're not allowed to engage, so they're very much the victim and the aggressor. That's the pattern that we've seen ever since the 1950s and before. I've always said, by the grace of God, go I. For some reason, I've been in the position where I've been more able to ask questions and have answers back. Now, whether those answers are true or false, I've always been quite cautious, but I've had a dialogue. So it's allowed me to build up a picture. And again, I'm not saying that picture is entirely accurate, but over 50 plus years of experience, I haven't changed that vision or that picture hasn't changed in interaction. Most of the interaction will be with what we call in Britain the mantids, what the Americans call the mantis, or what we all call the reptilians. I have met the greys. I don't particularly like them.
I remember you saying that. is it because they're kind of like, you said that, like biological robot, like there's no soul in them, or is there another reason? Is it just a negative vibe about them?
No, I think you've hit the nail on the head, because most of them don't have a soul. They're like an artificial intelligent machine. But I think there's a little bit of revulsion here, because you see, these creatures were originally humanoid. They sold their soul to the devil. As part of their deal, this is the route they went down. And so, you know, technically they were humanity, and they're not really now. So they're a bit of traitors, really, to humanity. And I feel desperately sorry for them, because they are trapped in a position of their own making. But nevertheless, I've ever since I was, 3 or 4 years old, I've never really warmed to them. I've never really taken to them.
And I seem to remember you saying in previous interviews that you had things kind of holographic images that beings would create for themselves. Am I right in thinking like a tiger or giraffe or something?
What you're thinking of there is 1963, when I had measles, and it seems incredible now, but I was 3 years old, 3.5 years old. And my mother said, I'm just going to leave you and I'm going to go to work. but she knew that I would be quite safe. And then an incident occurred where an entity sort of approached cut a long story short, wanted to put an implant into my hand and asked me permission to do that. And I asked, was it a good thing or a bad thing? And the entity replied, well, if you want the senior alien to know where you are every minute of the day, then it's a good thing. But if you don't want them to know where you are, it's a bad thing. And I said, well, I wanted this being to know where I was because it felt protected. So I said, I'll do it. And what was incredible was that it was a ball, a small marble, and it split in two to what we would now call an implant, and inside was a minuscule type implant, and somehow the skin on my hand literally peeled back and there was no blood. That's what's incredible, no blood. And this really frightened me, and just as today a doctor, when he or she gives an injection to a child, will say to the child, look away. What this entity said to me was, oh, look at the animals that have come to play. And when I looked, there was, I think, a cheetah and a giraffe. Now, of course, they weren't real. It was just in my head. But so that wasn't a real, that was just an image given to me so that I didn't see this thing going into my hand.
Mm. And this is kind of like a recurring thing because, Neil, you probably remember the Kinsellas. And I can't remember if it was Ronnie or Philip. Simon, I don't know if you've heard of the Kinsellas.
I haven't, no.
They're wonderful. They're kind of like the psychic craze, but they're not negative. They're very positive. From Bedfordshire, two mediums, very, very mediumistic and psychic. Actually, I think it's more Philip that's the medium.
Philip is the medium. Ronnie will always say that he hasn't got any ounce of psychic ability whatsoever, but he has had some very interesting experience all the same.
Mm. And both of them are experiences, and one of them had an experience of seeing a very evil looking grinning Cheshire cat on a ceiling when they were quite young.
That was Ronnie's experience.
What do you reckon that would be, Simon? What would be the point of that?
Oh, it's classic. And what will happen is that this is what we'd call a djinn. They're usually in the corner. They go up into the ceiling, into the corner. They would best be described as like piranha fish with the sharp teeth. But what will happen is that these entities, they're interdimensional entities. They exist between the third and the fourth dimension. And they will go into a child's head. And if the child has just seen, a cartoon or a film, they will pick out from that child's head an image and superimpose that. So you're talking about Alice in Wonderland here. So let's just say that this young person as a kid had seen Alice in Wonderland on the TV or the cinema, and that Cheshire Cat had made quite an impression. The entity is able to go into the mind banks, your memory banks of your organic brain, find that image, superimpose that, because they don't actually want to frighten you. They don't want to show you what they look like. So they will go for something that you have recently seen. So that's what that was.
Yeah, Ronnie actually pretty much came to a very similar conclusion, actually. And I think what it was prior to that, he said that he felt he was going to have this operation by an entity and he didn't want the operation. And I can't remember the time frame, but it was not long after that he said he saw this Cheshire cat face grinning at him in his bedroom. But they both had some kind of ET experiences. And I know Philip, his twin brother, has a theory to do with the greys themselves. Not totally necessarily the whole race of greys, but maybe a fraction of them. And we talked about their soulless creatures that he believes they're trying to somehow interfere with the human race. Whether this ties up with your stuff, I don't know, Simon. But he's got a theory that they're trying to regain their connection to the Godhead by blending their genetics with ours, in the sense of stopping themselves becoming soulless creatures. I mean, that's it in a nutshell, but Philip can explain it a lot better than I can.
Mm.
Well, first of all, just for clarification, if the Cheshire Cat is in the corner of the ceiling, sort of 8-9 feet up, that is a djinn. If it's hovering at about 2 to 3 feet floating in the air, then that is a holographic projection.
So,
if you ask where he saw it, if it's up in the corner, that's a demonic entity. If it's sort of 2 to 3 foot off the ground, then that's a holographic projection to take his mind off whatever they're doing. I don't quite buy that with the greys. I think that's been quite popular for a number of years. My experience is somewhat different. I'm absolutely convinced that the vast majority of the greys are working for the reptilians. And the reason that the greys are used is because they're humanoid. They are much smaller. They seem less offensive, and therefore they are able to work with humans in a much more cooperative way than a 7, 8, 9, 10 foot reptilian. So the greys are used as the middleman, and what they're trying to do is to obtain a semi-organic body that can maintain a soul that can survive in the third, fourth, and fifth dimension. So it's something that's been going on for hundreds of years, because they know the future. They obviously have the technology. They've seen where humanity is going, and they are absolutely desperate to ascend out of the third dimension through the fourth, because they're trapped in the fourth, remember, and they want to ascend from the fourth into the fifth. But the earth is not going to have that, because you can only ascend into the fifth dimension if your frequency is of the right level, the right frequency. And at the moment, the Draconis reptilians and the greys with a soul in are not ready to evolve. So they're trying to beat it. They're trying to go through the back door. And that's what this is all about.
Mm. This is where it gets really messy, Simon, because you'd probably concur with this. I suspect there are many species, many races with many different agendas. It's not just like a negative agenda or a positive agenda. There's probably multiple ones. Would you agree with that?
Yes. Remember also that from a human perspective, we judge good and evil or right and wrong from our perspective. But So what we think is evil or wrong, they think is absolutely perfectly right. So when you distill it down, you've got negative, positive, and in the middle.
Yeah, I think you're right. Where do you think that, this is something that I've been pondering for a while, where do you think the absolute pure evil comes from? We're talking the people that do like medical experiments in Auschwitz and people like that, that have no empathy, no care whatsoever, and just enjoy killing and genocide. Where is this coming from?
It's coming from the fourth dimension, no question of it. We would call that the lower fourth, where there's been a combination of some form of agreement between demonic energy and a reptilian life form. So a demonic energy and a reptilian consciousness have come together, and that is often what produces some of the most horrific things that we can imagine.
And what's their kind of like their purpose, or why have they chosen that path, do you think?
They've chosen it out of arrogance, because they believe that they've reached the top of the tree, the pinnacle of evolution. If you look at a snake today, that snake is many, many millions of years old, you know, in terms of its lineage, and hasn't changed at all. So their argument is that the reptilians have created a form that doesn't need to change. So they look at mammals, that's what we are, and they see it as weakness, the fact that we have to alter and change. Whereas I personally think that we're very adaptable. And, you know, if you take a snake in the desert and you suddenly turn it to Arctic conditions, that snake will die. But if you take a human, and as has happened in the past, and suddenly flip the temperature around, humans can survive. So I think that our very survivability is linked to our adaptability, but the reptilians are very arrogant and think the opposite.
Yeah. And interestingly, we're kind of the only species that in our naked flesh, we're not really adapted to this world. So every animal that you can think of is either adapted to, as you say, the Arctic or the desert or the rainforest or whatever. But we need clothes. You know, we can't even really survive out in the woods in England without clothes. We'll die of hypothermia overnight. So we haven't got fur, we've got hair, but it's not enough to kind of keep us warm. It's do you think this is because this theory of mammals or some kind of humanoid creature that was hairy and was kind of adapted to this earth being interjected by another alien race? Do you think that's why we're not fully adapted to the earth?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we were adapted to the earth, but we were adapted to one geographical location. In the Bible, we'd call it the Garden of Eden.
Yeah.
When the reptilians artificially altered humanity, and I want to make it clear that humans have been on this earth for a very long time, but the group that's prevalent at the moment, Homo sapiens sapiens, that is the product of the final experiment. And humans were adapted to a very amiable climate, a very warm climate where you didn't need clothes, where it was literally not barren rock. It was a pasture, a green grass. So humans were adapted for a very small geographical area, and when humans then moved away from that area into the hostile world that we describe, that's when humanity had to suddenly decide how it was going to cope, and as you said, make clothes or make a fire or live in a cave or do what have you. So we were taken from a very protected and I don't mean that in a good way, we were taken from a very controlled environment. And when humanity broke free, it then had to survive.
How old do you think the human race really is in our form, in our current form, not kind of like
250,000 years in our current form? If you were to go back, probably about 330,000 years. Before that, we're talking very much I don't like the word a monkey, but very much a subhuman. You see, if aliens have been arriving on this planet over the last 5 million years, let us say that a group lands, they find some small monkeys, maybe a foot in size, climbing around the trees, and they look at it and they say, well, this is the most promising thing. So they do a little bit of genetic work and they go away. And then half a million years later, a completely different group of aliens arrive and they see what's been achieved and they say, well, we'll do a bit more. So it was like that until the last reptilian task force arrived. And instead of the great experiment, what the reptilian group said is, well, these creatures can work for us. And that's when it became a master-slave environment. There was also the fact, of course, that humanity contained 12 strands of DNA, and the reptilians do not have 12 strands of DNA, and they very much wanted that. So there was this not love-hate relationship, but they saw humans as a resource. They didn't see them as something to wipe out. They saw them as something to control.
Like a farm.
Yes, exactly, like a farm. And it's been totally like that from about 250,000 years to this very day.
So is there any light at the end of the tunnel with this crazy situation?
There is, but for full release, it's going to require humanity to make some pretty tough decisions, which at the moment they're not really in a position to do. For instance, if we go to a supermarket, you will find long aisles of a meat, beef, lamb, whatever you want, and it's just packaged. And what the reptilians do is they say, well, you humans, you eat every lesser life form, so why can't we eat you? So if humans tomorrow stopped eating meat, the energetic pressure that would place would completely destabilize this top-down environment. So as long as humans in a critical mass keep eating meat, then anything else above us would think, well, we can do the same.
Kind of putting devil's advocate hat on, personally, I'd much prefer to look after animals and treat them well, and ideally I'd like to be, I'm kind of like a theoretical vegetarian or theoretical vegan, but I do kind of like appreciate that this world is a kind of dog eat dog world, and animals, even if you take humans completely out of the equation, animals would still eat animals, cats would still eat mice, dogs would probably still eat rabbits. What I'm kind of trying to say is, if source, let's take God, source, whatever you want to call it, as being love, why would something of love create a world and environment of such carnage within the animal kingdom?
Because it is only the human race that has guilt. It is only the human race that has a consciousness that knows good and evil. Every other animal lives to survive. They don't make the choice. They're not tested. They're not questioned with making that choice. Therefore, they do neither good nor evil. They exist. But humanity was given the consciousness to know the difference between right and wrong. And that is where the test is. The test is with humanity, not with the lower animals.
However, would it be kind of like a monkey wrench thrown in to say there are some killer whales who play around with seals for fun before killing them? And somebody said, I can't remember if it was yourself actually, that cats actually play with mice to get high on some kind of pheromone that makes them go, you know, like catnip. Would you say that that's kind of, you know, a sadistic nature revealed?
Well, if you're going to do genetic experiments 250,000 years ago on humans, you don't just go and experiment on humans. What you do is you take the lower life forms and you test it out there, and you'd have to test it on a mammal, excuse me. So you test it out, and once you've got what you think is right, then you move to your primary source. And if you look at a cat, a domestic cat, it is a mammal, yet it has the same eye as a snake.
Yeah.
And no single vet has ever effectively explained to me why a mammal should evolve a snake eye. That's not where it ends. If you think about a cobra, it hisses when it's angry. So a cat hisses when it's angry. A snake actually has a sensing organ, not on its tongue so much, but on the roof of its mouth. And when a snake puts its tongue out, it's actually wafting air against the sensor on the roof of its mouth so that it can get a picture. And a cat has exactly the same organ on the roof of its mouth. And the cat doesn't stick its tongue out. If you are a cat owner, you may have seen your cat open its mouth and it's doing the same. So there's absolutely no way Charles Darwin could sit down if he were alive today and explain to me how a mammal has all the traits of a reptilian. And I believe that the domestic cat was experimented on prior to humans. Now, what happens is that when a mammal is terrorized, it releases a pheromone. And unfortunately, the reptilians they look on it as a drug. And when they did all these experiments with domestic cats, they passed that trait across. So a cat will terrorize a mouse because when a mouse is terrified, it releases a pheromone hormone, which gets the cat high. And killer whales, I'm not quite clear on that, but it is along the same similar line. That is why a killer whale, it's not really a shark. It doesn't make sense. Why is a killer whale so vicious and angry when you look at those animals around it and they're not like that at all? And that's again because there's been alteration.
This is one of those talks that could go on for hours and hours. Neil, what have you got to jump in on?
Yeah, I was just thinking back to, you know, we were talking about the reptilians and the greys in the various dimensions, but we also talked about the different craft that have come crashing to Earth because they've been having fights above the Earth's surface. Now, just to make this clear to listeners and myself, of course, are we talking about craft that are coming from other solar systems in space, or is there a mix of other creatures coming from other dimensions in craft to the Earth?
Yeah, that's a very good question. The answer is both. Anything that comes here in real time is an extraterrestrial. I know it's not fully understood by people who are not into the subject, but let's say, for instance, the Tall Whites, which is a group that a guy called Charles Hall
wrote
a couple of books about. Now, they're extraterrestrials. They take something like 25, 27 years to get here. But a reptilian does not travel in the same way. A reptilian will open a portal, so they'll come here in about a second. So they are extra dimensional entities because they are traveling extra dimensionally. So a Tall White is an extraterrestrial, and a djinn or a demon is an interdimensional entity because it lives between the third and the fourth dimension. So these are the technical terms used rather than just the word alien.
Right. Go on, Andy.
I was going to say, now, onto the subject of the djinn. Simon, I think I've heard you say that there was a race of beings before humans that were kind of booted off into another dimension, and they were a bit pissed off about that, hence them being quite negative towards humans. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, the entity that we today we call a djinn, in 1,000 years' time, it may be called something completely different. But that's the term we'll go with, simply because the Muslim race, through their Quran book, use that term. And they're the most accurate of any human race on Earth with their information on it. So I choose that name because it's the accurate one today. These beings were semi-organic. They were part energy, part organic, and they did live on the Earth before humanity. And what we don't understand is that when you put 100 people in a room, the collective consciousness, although you can't see it, some people are quite sensitive, they can feel it. Well, when you multiply and multiply and multiply, it becomes actually like a barrier, a wall to any creature that is not fully organic. So these creatures were literally pushed out of our understanding, our reality. But human consciousness was a bit like a bulldozer pushing the snow, and then it sort of stops and leaves a line of snow and then goes back and pushes some more. So these creatures never get pushed into the fourth dimension. They got wedged between the third and the fourth. They believe that humanity deliberately dispossessed them of their earth. They consider the earth theirs. And as a result of that, ever since then, they've been looking at ways of getting back to the earth and causing trouble for people.
So would this be the time period roughly between kind of like the dinosaur period and, say, early man?
No. This would be quite relatively new. We're talking about human consciousness. Until the final upgrade, which was about 250,000 years ago, a human being could not contain any soul other than a third dimensional soul. So you have higher dimensions. People talk about Palladians or Andromedians. Those souls could not have inhabited the human form prior to that because the makeup of the body was not right. That's why they had to live in dolphins and whales, because those creatures' spirituality was at such a level they could maintain those much higher pulsing vibrations. Now, we're talking about literally 250,000 years ago, or 300,000 years when the human race for the underground work were created. So any time from literally 300,000 years to about 120,000 years to the start of what we would call Cro-Magnon man, that is when I think these djinn creatures were expelled from our reality.
Mm. So would there have been, because I'm trying to get my head around this, would there have been a point where the early man like was small in number and walking around with the djinn and would recognize the djinn?
I think only psychic people would have perceived them, unless the djinn actually wanted to be seen. Mm. I think that what we should understand is that one moment these creatures are here and the next minute they're not. In other words, when a critical mass of humans on the planet, the great consciousness awakening occurred, it doesn't matter whether you've got 50 people in Newcastle or 600 people in New York. Around the planet, this consciousness reached a critical level, at which point anything that was not of the same frequency was expelled. So we can't actually say that early people were walking around with these creatures. What we can say is these creatures would come through into the reality to try to torment or have a go at whatever they found.
And would this be linking into things like the sacrifices, the Aztec, Inca, and that kind of thing, sacrifices? Apparently there was one week where something like 80,000 people were sacrificed in a week after building a pyramid in Teotihuacan, I think it is, or probably pronounced that wrong, but one of the most famous kind of Aztec type villages or towns had this pyramid. 80,000 people in a week. Would that be a djinn, or would that be reptilian influence?
Well, that's a reptilian influence. What would happen is that, and did happen, was that senior royal members of the reptilian family would hold sway over a particular group for 100 years, 500 years, 1,000 years, sometimes longer. And then they would go and they would set up another group. So the group that went to talk about the Mayan, the Inca, and the Aztec, that was one of those reptilian lords, and he took with him the sacrifice culture, which he'd had in ancient Egypt, which he'd had in Babylon, Sumeria, and that's the culture, and he just brought the technology with him, which is the pyramid, and this is the same guy that then, the last time we can track him, would be to the Zulus in Africa, took the, not the pyramid culture, but the same and a more advanced sacrifice fighting culture. So you've got one entity with a different name, because each group of humans give this entity its own name, but in reality it's the same one with the same vision.
Would this be your previous experiences with Anu? Is that the same being?
Well, it wouldn't be Anu, it would be one of the sons of Anu. Mm. Enlil or Enki.
What do you think the Enlil or Enki would actually look like? Are we literally talking kind of walking lizards, standing up lizards or dragons?
Okay, it's a bit derogatory to refer to them as lizards, but it would be very honourable to call them dragons. Right. The Draconis Reptilian believe, rightly or wrongly, that they have evolved from dragons. That's exactly where they believe they came from. And they vary. It would be 1965 or 1966 when I was actually physically standing next to one of the sons. So it's incredibly hard because I would probably been about, 4 foot tall. And I was supposed to, the culture when you're in this type of environment, you're supposed to put your hand on the shoulder. So the eldest son puts his hand on his father's shoulder. The next youngest son puts his hand on the left shoulder of the older son. Now I couldn't do that because I'm just 4 foot tall. So I could only reach the kneecap, just above the kneecap. So these creatures get to be what, 9 foot tall.
Okay. And how kind of regularly do they show up in your life? Is it kind of like a weekly thing, a monthly thing, a yearly thing?
Well, not at the moment, because I went through a period where I rejected. I had to make a choice, and I rejected them. And that was about, 5 years ago. And since then, I haven't had a single experience with them, although the what we call the mantid or the mantis, that's probably a monthly thing now. Other experiences occur. But prior to me rejecting this reptilian experience, it was more regular. And as a boy, it would have been, I've got hundreds of memories and I put them down as drawings. It must have been weekly or at least fortnightly.
So for want of a better word, the mantis or mantids are on the more of the positive side, you'd say?
They are, simply because the agenda that they're following for themselves is more beneficial to humanity.
Have they told you what their ultimate objective is, their goal for kind of, first of all, interacting with you, and secondly, for humanity as a whole?
Well, the two are linked. They wish to go to the fifth dimension, bottom line.
How would you describe the fifth dimension?
A place where the word Satanism doesn't exist. A place where the word paedophilia doesn't exist, because the energies that we give those names to have no home there. A place where we don't need money. Money doesn't have any hold. A place where we are not service to self, but service to others.
Is this what we would call the spirit world, or is that something else?
No, that's totally different. Your spirit world is where a disincarnate body has not yet ascended, has not yet found an organic body, and therefore is for those who have the gift, can be through mediumship or can be channeled, because they can they're still in the capability of reaching into this world and another world. So they're between the two worlds. But once they go into a physical body, then they don't do that, because then they're back on the earth or back somewhere, and they're living either in an organic form if they're up to the sixth dimension. But if they're beyond the sixth dimension, remember that the seventh dimension is the cutoff point between the physical and the non-physical. So let's say somebody dies and they go to the ninth dimension, then you could channel them because they're not actually in a physical world. And it's very easy to come down the ladder channeling information. It's very hard to go up. So that's why people who are genuine channelers receive information. They don't give it, they receive it, because we can take information coming down. We can't push it up the ladder. It's very hard.
So in kind of layman's terms, in terms of how we as humans in bodies would experience the fifth dimension, would it literally be a case of you would wake up one day and all of the George Soros's and Jeffrey Epstein's and Harvey Weinstein's would just not be in our reality? Or how would it be? How would the fifth dimension actually be?
It's one of the hardest questions. It's the transference from this reality to that reality. And I don't have the answer for that. I've speculated for years, you know, do we have suddenly make a choice? Do we suddenly get offered a choice and we have to make that choice? Or the life we're leading now, is that making the choice for us? I think what I come down on the side of is that the evil people will suddenly disappear, as they are doing now. And suddenly you think, well, actually, what happened to this person or what happened to that person? And over the last 5 to 6 years, the good people have got better, the bad people have got worse, and the group in the middle are being forced to choose which side of the fence they want to be in. And this is part of the selection process.
I mean, it's all coming out, isn't it? It's like, really is like a Twilight Zone. You've got the Jeffrey Epstein Island. And I don't know if you've seen the pictures of the island, but it's literally like some Eyes Wide Shut type temple. It just looks like a satanic, you know, sacrificial type building. And you've got all of these people and even like celebrities like Brad Pitt. And I think, Corey Feldman, the Goonies guy, basically saying that Hollywood is run by elitist pedophiles. And you've got people talking about clones as well within Hollywood. It's just bizarre. I mean, if I think back to like the 1980s or the 1990s, when life was in quotes normal, like how it is now, it's just complete woo-woo land.
I think that's why Jeffrey Epstein was arrested, because he is the keystone. He's the major player here. And the question is, will he play ball? Will he provide information which leads to some of the biggest names ever to come forward and be prosecuted? Or will he decide to be quiet and not? So there's no coincidence that he was. You see, the thing was that he'd done a runner and he'd left all his diamonds. He'd literally left all his diamonds in his safe. And a very clever operation was undertaken to make him believe that he had 2 days grace. So he landed and the agents actually stormed the airplane. He hadn't even got off the airplane. And this is important because they made sure his feet didn't touch the ground, so he didn't actually touch American soil, because he was on a Saudi Arabian passport. He'd come back for his diamonds. Gold is no good because it's too heavy. You can't carry tons of gold with you. It's not negotiable. But these were small 1-carat diamonds and up. And literally, I've been told, there were literally handfuls of diamonds in his safe. And this was what he was going to come back for, to buy his escape, buy his freedom. So he was very cleverly captured. The question is now whether he's going to be prepared to sing like a canary or not.
Well, apparently he's been injured in his cell. In other words, they probably try to take him out. I would imagine if he was him, he would probably say, if you're going to take me down, I'm going to take the whole House of Cards down with me.
Well, he's been told he's facing 45 years in prison. I have been told that if he cuts a deal with them, he'll do 10 years in prison, and then he'll have a complete name change, $10 million, and be relocated somewhere. So he'll be on a protection program. So it's whether he thinks it's worth just doing 10 years or whether it's worth dying in prison. He will decide what he wants to do.
How do you feel the future is for Trump? I mean, that's a big question, isn't it? is he on the right path, or is he kind of like slowly being engulfed in the cesspit that he's trying to drain?
No, I think that the only days I will be worried is when the national media start being nice to him. So as long as the mainstream news hate him, that's because they don't control him. If you think of every other president bar Kennedy, the newspapers love them. And that's because he was part of their agenda. You know, and I mean, we don't want to bring politics into it, but one of the reasons, rightly or wrongly, one of the reasons that Corbyn, the leader of the Labour Party in Great Britain, is hated is because he's not controllable as well. He's not come up through the approved route. It doesn't matter whether you vote Conservative or Labour or Democrat or Republican. These previous leaders were all part of the same group. And so the status quo didn't care who was in, they got what they wanted. But Trump wasn't part of that, and neither is Corbyn. So sometimes, and something is happening that's bringing individuals up who are not part of the club. And that's why the state-controlled media are turning on these people, because they fear them. No, Trump is not being blown off course. Trump is having to steer a very difficult situation, It's not anything as easy as people believe it is. And I'm very frustrated. I want him to get on and knock heads together and go and do it. But, you know, there are a number of nuclear weapons knocking around, which, you know, nobody really has control over. And so, you know, you do have to be careful. And the submarine incident that we saw recently was a warning that, you know, there are still these very evil elements about. I think Trump's doing the best he can under the circumstances.
This is an interesting one, Simon. I don't know if you touched on this. Apparently, Lufthansa and British Airways have stopped flying flights to Egypt. What's going on there?
Yeah, it's probably more to do with the lack of democracy going on. There's been lots of times when people have gone to visit for the pyramids and they've had armed guards with them. Mm. It's nothing new. There is a report which is not in the normal media, but there's a report that somebody's got hold of a surface-to-air missile and is threatening to shoot down. So they're flying certain routes and flying other routes, keeping separate from it. You know, we don't think of these missiles on the back of a great big tank or tractor. These things are portable. They're man portable. Mm-hmm. And they can go up to about, 15, 20,000 feet. Some of them are not as effective as that. But the reality is that when there's a credible warning that there is a real potential of one of these, then the civilian airlines, they don't say anything. They just divert their aircraft.
Mm. It's interesting because a friend of mine who you've actually met at High Elms is half Egyptian, and she went to Egypt recently. And how's this for fake news? She said Egyptians kept coming up to her and asking, why do the British and the West, why do they hate Egyptians? And she was like, what are you talking about? We don't hate Egyptians. And they say, but we're told that you guys, you hate us, you hate the Egyptians. And she said, no, that's not the case at all. Their media in Egypt is telling their citizens that the Western Europe hate Egyptians. I mean, that's, you know, the epitome of fake news. I don't know what
I haven't heard that. That's new to me.
Bizarre.
You've told me that and I totally believe you. Yeah. So I don't know what the game is. There's going to be a subplot going on there. There's going to be some game that's to do with political trade or a political action or somebody didn't scratch somebody's back. So I would think that's got more to do with money than it has to do with anything else.
Mm. And just to put it out there, if we do have any Egyptian listeners, we do not hate Egyptians at all. So I don't know, you do not believe your media. It was quite eye-opening, actually. You know, we think that fake news is just kind of like a modern thing within the West, but with the certainly the US media and the British media, but it seems to be kind of like a worldwide thing.
Well, I think when a small group of people manage a very large group, they will use any tools of the trade at their disposal if they believe that that group will want to dispossess them. You know, we saw it with Adolf Hitler, you know, in Great Britain. The war started in September 1939, and within 3 to 4 weeks, Winston Churchill had brought in rationing. You couldn't get anything except on what was called back then the black market. But Hitler was so frightened of people coming to power in the same way he did that he didn't do that. And you could go in December 1942 into a German department store and you could buy perfume. Mm-hmm. So sometimes rulers are so concerned that the mass of people will rise up against them, that they will use a carrot and stick approach. And that's what Hitler did. He did a carrot and stick approach. And many of these leaders do exactly the same with their people.
Mm. That's a whole new topic in itself. Neil, I think have we wound to the end of our...
We have reached past our hour with Simon. So, yeah, I'm afraid, I mean, like you say, it could go on and on. There's so much more hours, topics that I would love to ask questions, and I'm sure that maybe we'll get an opportunity to do that at some point. Just like to say thank you very much indeed to Simon Parks for sparing an hour of his time, which is obviously very valuable for the Paranormal Peep Show this evening, and we hope our listeners have enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you, Simon. We've absolutely fascinating conversation. I've wanted you on for probably about 2 or 3 years now, so I'm very, very grateful that you've come on.
Well, I'm very grateful that you asked me, and you know, and I'm pleased to do it. And if the response to this is positive and if people have enjoyed it, they'll let you know. And then, you know, hey, we can just rebook, can't we?
We can indeed.
Okay. And Simon, once again, people, if they want to find out more about you, they can go to your website if you want to give that out.
Yes, they can. It's simonparkes.org. And if they would like to join Connecting Consciousness, there's no fee to pay. You just click on the icon and you just sign yourself up. That's fine.
Are you doing any talks or have you got any books going at the moment,
Simon? I don't go into books because I feel at the moment the way to reach the public is by direct face-to-face work. I think when I retire, I might write a book. Mm-hmm. And have some deep held plans, things I want to do, build a healing center. I very much want to do that. You know, I want to change the way that government actually works and relates to the ordinary people. I have a very strong vision about what's fair, what's right, and what's wrong. I don't get interviewed on BBC anymore because they tried to make a fool out of me and it failed. And so they don't invite me anymore. I'd still do some, you know, conferences. And if people write to me, I'll have a good look at it. And if it's something that I could, you know, contribute towards, then I would accept that.
Brilliant.
That's great. Thank you. Well, thank you very, very much indeed. And you've been listening to the Paranormal Peep Show with myself, Neil Geddes Ward, and Andrew Chaplin. And you've also been listening to Simon Parkes. We'll be right back.